back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And I have bad news for the audience. This is Minute 71, which we've titled The Return of the 107th. And unfortunately, poor Hal does not get to do any accents, unless he wants to, in this particular minute. Hal, let's do the descriptive narration of this particular minute.
All right. In the original Klingon, as requested.
Kapla.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I need more phlegm. All right. The Return of the 107th. Peggy Carter and Colonel Phillips step out of the command tent, alerted by the growing clamor. The camp gate swings open, and over a rise in the road, Steve Rogers and Bucky Barnes lead a triumphant procession.
It's
can
just
I just
not your
do
day.
The whole thing from the top?
I'm let's roll it back. Rip, 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 rip.
Yes, okay.
Beep, beep, beep.
Yeah, maybe you should try it in Huttese.
Yeah. Yeah, I should. It might be easier.
And Klingon with him, yeah.
Morje wojo, soro.
Some bijolet.
Iwana wago. All right. Peggy Carter and Colonel Phillips step out of the command tent, alerted by the growing clamor. The camp gate swings open, and over a rise in the road, Steve Rogers and Bucky Barnes lead a triumphant procession of the 107th escapees. Dozens of soldiers march behind them, flanked by captured Hydra tanks and trucks, their futuristic designs muted under the gray sky. Cheering men line the path, their shouts of welcome cutting through the heavy air. Steve, in his battered Captain America gear, glances at Bucky, who trudges beside him, weary but alive. They share a quiet smile, their mission accomplished, the weight of their victory etched in their expressions.
One thing I did not put in this narration, by the way, great narration there, Hal.
Well, no, I was just going to say great, great writing. This one, especially without dialogue, this one had, as always, very well written.
You painted a picture.
Well, the thing I left out, though, is one of the guys cheering men that come out. There's a very puzzled Gilmore Hodge. We get
Gilmore
to see.
Hodge, our old friend Lex Shrapnel for maybe
Lex
the
Shrapnel,
last time.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So
I didn't catch that. Great eye.
Yeah. So he's there, and he didn't get to be part of the Howling Commandos, which is a shame.
Right.
I would have liked more. Of course, as we talk with Lex. There's still a possibility they could bring him back somewhere else. He could have a whole nother story going on.
Well, maybe he could really go and join the British and report to Her Majesty.
Yes.
Well, Gilmore Hodge, Your Majesty.
Well, Lex showed me something, though, in this scene of him stepping out of the tent. He steps out of the tent and he watches Cap go by. And interesting emotions play across his face. Like, he's puzzled, but he's also... I think he's sort of, I don't know, impressed or something. He's like, oh, that's the skinny kid I used to make fun of. And he's got about 2 seconds there to express maybe three or four different emotions as he watches this procession go by. And I think it's a nice moment.
Yeah. And I was wondering if he thought that could have been me.
Yeah, maybe that was one of them. And one of his emotions was, exactly right.
Yeah.
If he'd gotten the breaks.
He's there and he's serving. He's doing his bit. But yeah, you do have to wonder if there's a, especially given his attitude earlier on, you know, it's like that either that could have been me or that should have been me.
Yeah. Yeah. This minute has it's one of my favorite minutes of the movies because it's one of my favorite tropes of all time in all film, which is the hero.
Brian,
appears.
I'm going to pause really quick and say, you have to trust me if I tell you after this is the same thing I was thinking of.
Oh, good. Well,
Craig, continue.
Please contribute. But it's just this trope of the hero cresting over a hill, and then the camera dollies, cranes up or dollies back, and you see the army behind him. The hero is vindicated. The music swells. The tide is turned. I was looking up this trope, and I found a quote that says, "This trope is deeply satisfying because it transforms the protagonist from a wandering lone wolf into a responsible guardian who earns the fierce loyalty of their followers." And I think that's a wonderful summation of this. It's the moment that all the army sees Captain America as the Captain America we know he's going to become.
And the use in the cinematography, the scene where it begins is a shot from the knees up. That's usually known as what's known as the American shot. And a lot of What the American shot does is it gives whoever is looking at a heroic stance. You can only do this from the middle distance. If you do it from a close-up, all you're doing is looking up people's nostrils. But if you do it in a wide shot from the knees up, it signals to the audience, the American shot signals to the audience that these are people you need to literally look up to. So it's just nice the way it starts that way.
It's perfect because both of you guys are describing pieces of the thing that is my favorite instant in this particular minute. And we were talking in the last episode about, you know, there's the grief, the down moment, even though Captain America's the star of the film, we're pretty sure he's going to survive and all this stuff, but there's that. And, you know, building towards this minute where we get that, as Brian said, the triumphant return, we get that, the release from the grief and the tension. And so Jim, talking about that American shot, the thing that I absolutely love is as we're low down knee level, I'm assuming we're dollying in, the gate opens.
Yeah.
To let us out, to free us from the tension, the grief, the worry, the anxiety, and all those things. As that gate goes up and we just move under it, it's opening to let them in, but it, from our POV, it's letting us out. It's releasing us from all that. And I just adored that.
Yeah. One wonders if, you know, Joe Johnston might have been able to avoid some of these. I use the word tropes. One might wonder about the word cliche, but I just don't think there's any other way to shoot this moment of this film. And I think he did it masterfully. He's using the tools in the toolbox to make us feel what he wants us to feel. And it's just so well done. Even if it's been done before, it's so well done.
Well, it's a way of communicating. The audience knows this. This is the language of film. We've seen it in, you know, John Sturges. You see it in Patton. You see this in Battleground. You even see this in movies like 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, where the people that are involved, if you're looking up at, and just in scrubbing through this particular minute, they do it three times. They go back down to the knees, looking up. Every one of these guys is a hero. It's telling you these guys have the mission accomplished. And then the follow up is the reaction shot. They're showing you are part of that heroic group. You're identified with them, and you see the soldiers that are in the camp clapping and cheering, giving thumbs up and things like that. So you feel you're part of their team. You're another one of the Howling Commandos, basically. So it's very, very subjective. There's not an omniscient look here.
You're right. Joe switches the POV around so that the camera is you. You're with Captain America. You're walking through the phalanx of soldiers on either side of you, looking at you, cheering you on like you're one of them. That's the
sort of second half of the reward of the payoff, right? That it's, you know, we go through the gate and we see everybody. Now we're relieved. Hey, our friends are back. And then, as you guys have said, now I get to run over with them and walk in with them as if I had a damn thing to do with it, but get to, you know, enjoy that celebration as well.
And
you know,
we've talked in the past, one of the, not only just the pictures that we're seeing here, but we've talked in the past with our composer, Tom Gear, who's going to be on our show in the near future. This is the second time that the bold, that orchestral march that we're hearing of Captain America, the Alan Silvestri theme that we're hearing, this orchestral march is, you know, very heroic. And the last time we saw it in the film was when that sarcophagus opens and we see Captain America for the first time. You know, Steve has become Captain America. So this is another cue to the audience that you're looking at heroes here now.
Yeah. And I noticed in this minute, and perhaps that previous minute, I have to go back and look at it, but that orchestral march starts with a single note, a single brass note. I don't know if it's a French horn or a trumpet. I don't know what it is. Just that. It starts out with that one note, one instrument playing one note, and then it builds and it builds and it builds. It's so well, so nicely done.
Yeah.
There's such a warmth to it, but it doesn't just come on instantly. It's just, here's this note. It's like, get ready, and as you said, we build from there.
Yeah, and we're getting that whole Marshall, you know, the Marshall theme. It's very the percussion, the rolling snare drums, and the, you know, and you hear the there's the two I wish we could talk to Alan Silvestri, but he hasn't said no yet. But I really would like to talk to him about the composition part of this, because there's that A section that you know, you get the one note, like you were saying, and then you get the five notes following. It's like a fanfare, and it has that, you know, it feels very commanding. And then when you get to the B section, there's it's kind of a, it's more a lyrical sound, more emotional sound. You're getting these the sounds with the not the French horns, but the baritones, and there's also some strings in there. You get it's like, you know, the Amber Waves of Grain kind of patriotism. You hear this song, and you feel like you're going to be hearing America the Beautiful playing, and it really works. Like, I don't want to say anticipation, but you feel like you've crested the hill. Just as we're seeing them crest the hill, you feel that march, and you want to join and march along too.
Right.
I had two examples of this, and this trope is not quite the same thing as the cavalry arrives, because we're not going into battle here. We've come from the battle. But I thought immediately of two things watching this movie. One was in The Lord of the Rings at the Battle of Helm's Deep, when we look up on the hill and we see Gandalf alone come over the hill ready to, and it's like, well, great, there's one guy, but Gandalf has a whole freaking army behind him charging over this hill at dawn to save Helm's Deep. And it's exactly what you were just talking about, Jim. It's that low shot. We're literally looking up at Gandalf on the top of a mountain pass, and then the army pours over that pass down upon the bad guys. And the other thing I thought, and this is a reach, but it's literally the first thing I thought of, was the end of The Music Man. When Professor Harold Hill, he's led his ragtag marching band of terrible musicians. And it's, again, it's that same shot, because they come in the movie anyway, they come out of, I don't know,
the high
school auditorium.
Yeah.
And you're down on the ground looking at them up 6, 7, 8 steps to the entrance of the auditorium. And here comes the band. And it's first it's Harold Hill, and then it's a couple of stupid, you know, bad musicians. And then it's 1,000 musicians in crisp uniforms, clearly a subjective experience of this town, thrilled to have their band. But it's just like, one of the earliest movie going thrills I remember was seeing The Music Man and seeing that army of musicians come out of that high school auditorium. It's like, oh man, it's a moment of triumph.
This is really strange, because that's one of my earliest memories of going to the movies, was seeing The Music Man.
Yeah.
It makes such an impression on you that, gosh, this is what it could be like. You know, this is something to ascend to.
Yeah, and they're marching down the street, and just like in Captain America, all the townspeople are along the curb. They're all cheering them and hooray, hooray! You know, the heroes have conquered. It's just, I don't know why, but it evoked the same emotions in me. And interesting to say that, you know, you have that same experience with that particular musical.
Yeah, it's amazing. Joe's directorial style relies a lot on the music, and I think music plays such an important part with him. I mean, maybe he brought that with him from his, you know, experience with John Williams and all the Star Wars movies, but you can tell that to him this is like a musical without words. Although, as we've seen in the past, he actually does have a musical buried in the middle of this. I think that's just always been his secret desire to do a musical. But it's just amazing how much he relies on the music to help tell the story.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, as we were talking about earlier, that's part of the language of film. He's using all the tools in the toolbox.
Right. And Brian, when you talk about tropes, you know, in you know, you're hesitant to use the word sort of cliche, and it's not like you're a little bit of hesitant to use that word. But to me, that term trope is kind of another name for a tool in the toolbox. And it is something that you use. And it's something that filmmakers have learned, that audiences respond to. And it's something I think filmmakers have taught us in, you know, 100 years of cinema to speak that language and understand that, you know, this is what this means. And that's what that means.
Speaking of color, I'd like to ask you this particular minute, we've talked about color in the past, and they're muted organic colors here, the greens, the browns. The only real blue that we're seeing are a couple of the weapon handles on the Hydra, you know, the captured Hydra equipment, And Captain America's shirt, he's the only one that really is carrying anything that has any bit of a lot of color. But I'm
Yeah,
just surprised that
even
the
the sky
Browns.
is a cloudy gray.
Yeah. But his shirt kind of shines through as the only thing that's saturated with color, and his helmet. So even in, in this group of brown background people, the khaki everywhere, his blue shirt seems to pierce through all of that fog.
Yeah, and this gray-green forest they're marching through, but you're right, and it works in story because that blue shirt is part of his chorus girl outfit. It's a stage uniform, it's not a fighting uniform. So the fact that it's kind of this brilliant blue makes sense. But it's interesting because he's wearing this leather jacket, so only a little bit of that blue shows. But you're right, it sure shines through. And then you've got the blue glow, the Hydra weapons, and I think partly what that does is that calls your attention to the fact that they've captured the Hydra weapon that brought them in. It's if they didn't have that blue glow, you might just not notice them, might think, well, okay, they're just carrying machine guns or what have you. But the blue glow draws your eye to the weapons and says, ah, they brought some Hydra stuff back. That's a whole nother plot line.
And that establishes in our minds why there's Hydra tanks coming right along behind them too. That we see, okay, they've got the guns, because otherwise you may see those Hydra tanks think, oh gosh, behind you, look out,
Yeah, look
more
out.
bad guys.
Yeah.
Speaking of all the guys marching, it's really interesting. I hadn't really delved into it until we got to this minute and started sort of scrolling back and forth. There's a really interesting and a really good representation of nationalities. This is not strictly the 107th that's coming back. You've got, as you would expect to see in any, German or enemy prison camp, you've got a fair number of pilots. Oftentimes, there was a higher percentage of them because they were the ones flying over enemy territory, getting shot down and captured. So you've got, I see both U.S. Army Air Forces and RAF pilots. There's British paratroopers, regular British Army,
There's a free
and
French force too.
yeah, there's at least two free French guys I was going to call out. You see a little bit of their red, white, and blue, although those they don't stand out the way Caps does. And then some guys in some sort of miscellaneous sort of civilian looking stuff,
Yeah,
and
I was
I
looking at the
see them
civilian looking
as
stuff, the page boy caps and those thing kinds of things,
Yeah.
like some little scrawny guys that you wonder if they were
Right.
just civilians who happened to get captured too.
Just French or Italian resistance, or who knows what. But two guys at least, and they are wearing the armbands for the Free French Army, which is a very nice touch. You sort of wonder, okay, where what was their path to get to this particular Hydra base, but.
Also kudos to the prop department for those tanks. The Hydra tanks look, I mean, it looks like they were repurposed. I'm assuming they're front loaders, that they just took the front loader off and painted it up and put a couple of plywood boards to make it look more tank-like. But they seem plausible and are obviously functioning.
Yeah.
So quite a great job. You can never have enough rivets on those things. It just
And I'm looking at the tanks now in our minute here, and what I like, and I didn't clock this till now, but very reminiscent of some of the actual footage and photographs you see from World War II, because the tanks are just there's guys riding on that. There many guys on top of that tank as can possibly fit to get a ride on that
Right.
tank, and it's just to me it's just kind of a neat, a very tiny realistic touch. Like,
Right.
sure, you're going to load probably wounded guys up there on the tank and drive them in, and but it just brought me back to those photos I remember seeing.
Yeah. Well, and it's the casual way they're kind of just lounging, sort of draped across the tank. Nobody's sitting up there like clinging with both hands and looking all tense and nervous. It's just, and I picture, as you said, Brian, there's some wounded guys, and then there's one or two guys who were just tired, and the tank slowed down, and they just clambered up there, and the guy driving the tank doesn't even know. But the way they're just, they're tired, they've been through it all, and a couple of them are going to just set the shame aside and take a free ride while they can.
Yeah,
Yeah,
this
well,
reality feels very lived in, and
yeah.
I believe that these guys have been in a POW camp for a while.
And remember, they were at the time, a couple of minutes back, when Colonel Phillips was explaining, they were 30 miles behind enemy lines. So they've walked at least 30 miles, unless the front is right there.
Right.
And yeah, it's they look in pretty good shape for doing that kind of a hike. But it's just still it's a stunning. One of the things that hits me is it's kind of a Spirit of 76 thing. You could have put fife and drum over this and it would have worked too, I think.
Sure.
Just, yeah, generally a solid, very solid minute.
Well, as I say, one of my favorite minutes of the film because it makes me feel what it wants me to feel, and it does it very effectively.
Yeah, and I think the other part of it is this is the first time Bucky and Cap are back together again post, you know, the last time they saw each other was at the World's Fair or the World Exposition of whatever technology, and they're teammates now. He was being rescued, but I think that that glance that they give each other, it's like, well, we're all on the same crew, and I think he's earned Bucky's respect, and Cap's just happy to you know have Bucky back in his life again, I think.
Yeah good observation. Wow,
that's a great point.
Well, I think we've squeezed every last bit of juice out of this particular minute. So
it was a juicy minute.
It was a very juicy minute, and you know, even though Hal didn't get to do some accents,
I did them inside.
You like, did. I could feel
where it counts, Jim.
Yeah, it's well, it's the allies we made along the way that really is important. But I know there's probably a lot of things we've missed in this minute. And if you would like to help us out, you could continue our conversation over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like and hopefully a comment at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode so other people can find this show too. We really appreciate that. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.